Hi, my name is Amy.
And my name is James.
And this is How I Learned to Love Shrimp, a podcast about promising ways to help animals and build the animal advocacy movement. A really insightful episode this week as we speak to Neil Dullahan from Rethink Priorities, who talks us through his policy research in the EU, as well as other exciting projects and impactful research that Rethink Priorities has produced. This episode was filmed in person at the Animal and Vegan Advocacy Summit in Los Angeles. So special thanks to Amy and the AVA team for accommodating us. We hope you enjoy. We're joined today by Neil Dullahan, Senior Research Manager in the Animal Welfare Department at Rethink Priorities. Neil also holds a PhD in political science. And it's a unique interview today. We're actually in person at the Animal and Vegan Advocacy Summit in the US. So it's really nice to be here in person and here to interview Neil. Welcome.
Thanks. Really great to be here in person.
So I'm just going to start with an opening question, get us going. What's the view that you hold that most animal advocates might disagree with?
So I don't know what most animal advocates think, but I'll use the 2021 Farmed Animal Funder survey of like 2,000 organizations that are fighting factory farming as a proxy. So like organizations reported most frequently working on egg-laying chickens, broiler chickens, and cows, and least frequently on fish, crustaceans, and other farmed invertebrates. And I think we should be spending much more of our time and resources on the literal like trillions of shrimp and billions of fish suffering out there in the food system. Mm. I imagine many advocates care about those animals. And of course, some of like what they work on could be driven by funding rather than what advocates think. But it does seem to me that many advocates don't have the view that we should be prioritizing these types of animals. And I think you would, if that were true, you would see more advocates willing to like set up groups working on shrimp and fish, which seems to be not the case right now.
Yeah, I think to our knowledge, there's one group focused only on shrimp and one group focused only on insects. And besides that, it's fairly sparse in the invertebrate landscape. You think that's probably correct?
Yep, that sounds right to me. And also very few groups working on farmed fish.
Sure.
Cool. So just maybe briefly, Neil, how did you get into animal advocacy and how did you end up at Rethink Priorities?
Yeah, so my background isn't in animal advocacy. My background is in political science. And I was finishing my PhD in political science at the European University Institute when I joined Rethink Priorities. And there was an opportunity to work on European Union farmed animal issues. And I had a comparative advantage there. And ever since then, I've just continued to work on farmed animals and seeing that that's a pressing and urgent place where I can deploy my skills effectively, and have just been more and more convinced by the literature in the movement that this is like an important issue that not just I, but other people should work on.
Very cool. And what do you think doing a PhD in political science has taught you that isn't common? Because I think animal advocates generally, I think, don't do that much work on politics. I think having a PhD in political science isn't particularly common. So yeah, any kind of hot takes on what you've learned from that? That's like unique.
So the first thing is just knowledge of the systems of decision-making. You know, who are the key actors? Who hold the veto powers? What are the veto powers? What are the key processes for making a decision? You know, what are the key votes? When are they? How are those votes decided? Like, I think in cases like the European Union, which is quite Byzantine, you know, it's really helpful to know those facts and to have some of the theories of decision making from political science to help you build a strategy, plan your actions, the timing of your actions, the tactics, who you have meetings with, who are the most important decision makers, rather than just a more vague approach of just
do policy.
Yeah.
Cool.
Another thing probably is the importance of coalition building. Seems to be pretty common to most successful movements that they're not just single issue, that they do find allies in many other movements, and that they avoid some of the classic pitfalls that you see in political science studies, where a movement internally disintegrates, but they couldn't get over some important divide. So you have both internal coalition building and also external coalition building. And it seems to me that more of that could be done and isn't being done. Mm. And then I think there's also this idea in political science about public opinion, that it's not actually like a real thing or like a stable thing, that people don't hold views about these esoteric topics that we in the movement would bring to them, and that they're very vulnerable to question wording, the context in which you ask them, what are the events happening around them, which we can use to our advantage.
Mm. Right.
Frame it in a way that is most appealing to them. But when you run a survey, you shouldn't assume that you're assessing the true feeling of the public, because that's quite malleable.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard, and seen myself in our work, you do a survey using one provider on one sample, you get one answer, you do it by another method, new question, whatever, very, very different answer on supposedly the exact same metric. So yeah, I think that's a big fallacy and yeah, tough problem.
And I think it's also reasonable for the public not to have a view on whether egg-laying hens should have 1 foot or 1.5 foot of space. They can have more solid opinions on general issues that were against animal cruelty, sure. But if you're pitching a specific policy to them and getting very technical into the weeds, you should really expect these biases to play a huge role.
Right. Great. So we're just going to move into a section on the EU-focused research, which a lot of your Rethink Priorities research has been focused on. What's the case that influencing the EU is a serious priority for animal advocates? What's the kind of top line hot take on this as a project?
Right. Well, the first thing to say is I have an obvious bias because that's where my comparative advantage is. I think influencing China is incredibly important, but I don't know how to do that. I wouldn't be able to do that.
Sure.
But I think the typical case for EU policy work is that a relatively small advocacy effort can convince a few key governments and a few key members of EU agencies to champion a reform and force a change in the other 27 countries that otherwise would not have reformed, or would have done so much slower and at greater expense to the advocacy movement.
Mm.
So one of the unique values of the EU policy change is that you can change baseline conditions across the whole industry in one swoop, backed up by enforcement mechanisms of the government, and leverage public funding and resources to do the work that otherwise the advocacy movement would have to do. The monitoring, the research, the enforcement, the coordination, and you can just outsource that to the EU across 27 countries.
Mm. You mean this is in opposition to doing corporate campaigns, whereas it has to be enforced by advocates, whereas if it's government legislation, it's going to be enforced by government bodies. Is that right?
Conditional on the government having good enforcement agencies.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, is that actually the case? I remember interviewing Edie Bowles from the UK and suggesting that often there isn't necessarily a framework in place to implement or be accountable for the change. Do you feel mostly you're confident in that across the EU? Is there a sense that that would be fulfilled?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't take it for granted, because we've seen in the case of the Barron battery cage ban in the EU that many countries waited until the last minute to do anything about it, and then still didn't actually ban the cages after the deadline.
Really?
But with an advocacy effort, particularly by groups like Compassion and World Farming, that went and documented that producers were still using cages and presenting that evidence to the European Commission, they were able to use the mechanisms of government to launch infringement proceedings and force those countries to comply.
Great, okay.
And it's not necessarily the case that you would have those enforcement mechanisms for more voluntary measures.
Yeah, wow, that makes sense. So powerful overall.
And in terms of, there's the one impact you kind of spoke about in terms of, that you can leverage the EU to influence other countries that wouldn't otherwise commit. But then there's also this thing I've heard, which is, I think, dubbed the Brussels effect, in that policy set by the EU can actually spread to other countries and influence them in a policy leadership kind of setting. And yeah, I guess, do you have any views on that and how real or how large that effect might be?
Yeah, so this is the idea that the EU single market is this enormous commercial opportunity for companies. And when the EU sets a new standard, it's often easier for a global company that wants to sell into this EU market to just change their entire supply chain to meet the EU standards, rather than have a very fragmented supply chain with different practices for each different customer in their global supply chain. I haven't seen any quantitative estimates of this effect. Most of my knowledge comes from this pretty obscure European Parliament report from Professor Broom, where they sort of mention some anecdotal evidence that EU standards on hygiene and stunning and slaughter and animal welfare-based outcomes have led to changes in Brazil and Argentina and Thailand and China. But I haven't seen like really detailed discussion of that and like clearly linking the causal mechanism with the EU regulation and actual changes on the ground.
Is there any non-animal related research on the Brussels effects? Do you know of?
There's like general research that shows there's definitely cases where it seems clear EU standards have then been adopted in other countries, even though it's not legally required to them because there's a commercial benefit.
Mm.
But it doesn't seem to be uniform. And I haven't seen like a meta-analysis that would like give you an effect size.
And more broadly, how important do you think it is that we have some policy leadership in those in the less neglected regions, even if they have small animal populations versus focusing on neglected countries with larger number of animals?
And concretely, this might look like the EU versus, you know, Southeast Asia, Indonesia, Thailand, Vietnam, where much less money goes to the movement, but the numbers of animals might be comparatively much larger.
I think there could be some value in taking a region that has maybe a small number of animals, but a strong advocacy movement, like Europe, to generate a precedent. And then you can use that precedent, gather the economic studies on how it's done, case studies of successful farms that use that new reform practice, and then advocates in these larger countries can show those to producers, to policymakers. It's like, this is actually possible. Yeah. And maybe you can do that more cheaply in a small country because it's easier to access the political opportunity structures. But I think it's like mostly valuable in these cases, like where you have the Brussels effect, where there's some sort of policy diffusion, where you can take what's been done in the small country, get it to a large country. But I don't think like we should be naive and just think, oh, we'll do a meat tax in Luxembourg and boom, China has a meat tax.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
It has to be part of a bigger strategy with a clear theory of change. So like, let's take this EU example. You identify a group of reform-minded countries. You pick a small one where you have strong advocacy movement. It's relatively easy to access the policymakers. Get them to introduce this meat tax or whatever policy you prefer. Then you have some precedent that you can bring to larger reform-minded countries, let's say Germany, show them, look, this isn't a crazy idea from advocates, like a real country near you has done this. They can adopt it in theory. And then you have maybe already a momentum within that region to push for a broader change. And in the EU, you have this mechanism where those countries can push the European Commission and the Parliament to introduce this reform to cover all of those countries. And then maybe if the Brussels effect applies, then you can like maybe extend it to China or other countries. But again, I think you should like actually map out the steps of how you would go from change in this small country to change around on a much larger scale and not engage in like magical thinking.
It'll just somehow magically diffuse through the world. Okay, cool.
So unless you have that, I'm pretty happy with like the idea that we should spend a lot more resources in bigger countries.
Yeah.
Countries that have been more neglected and have a lot more neglected animals, and only like spend marginal resources in these small countries when you have like a clear idea of why this will be worth it.
And maybe just give a sense of where current money is going, and do you think it's in the proportion you feel is reasonable? Or if you could magically control all the money in the movement, how would you reallocate things based on what you just said?
I think the amount that recently has been going to the EU is more than in the past. It seems like appropriate for this sort of small country policy diffusion. But the amount of money going to these more neglected regions in Asia and South America still seems like not where would be optimal if we want to like build the movement and have the most impact on the most number of animals. I think the real problem is just like, are there tractable opportunities? And maybe it's just the case that we have to spend a lot of money to build the pipeline of people, to build the movement that they can then launch these tractable. And that can be like less appealing, I understand, from the funding perspective.
Yeah.
But I think like you have to do the work.
Yeah. Yeah. For the long-term gains, definitely. And to have that as like a sustainable model, I think without a sustainable org at the helm of taking that on and pursuing that policy, I think, even though there could be some, maybe like a short-term win, it's unlikely to be very sustainable. Interesting.
Maybe one thing I'll chime in there is I was just speaking to people who are doing great capacity building work in Asia at Welfare Matters, and they were saying they've been running this fellowship to get more people into the movement in six Asian countries, but actually people often finish a fellowship and now they don't know where to work because there's not many open roles left in the established NGOs. So it's, you know, where do they go? So where are these organizations? Who do they campaign for? So I think maybe this comes back to the idea of, do we need more opportunities for people to actually get into there? But yeah, that's a whole other big topic, maybe for another episode.
But, and that can also include people setting up those opportunities.
Exactly.
Right?
Right. Yeah.
Build the pipeline of people there, and then they can set up
new
opportunities themselves rather than waiting for some magic wand.
Yeah. And in terms of the sort of positive outcomes of this, then I think End the Cage Age is a really good example here of, so End the Cage Age was a European citizens initiative to phase out all cages for lots of different species within the EU, which was agreed to by the European Commission. So this has gone through. So what's the update with this, and how likely is it? We were talking before about kind of accountability and making sure the commitment is fulfilled. How likely do you think this is to be honored over the longer term?
So I think a clarification that comes from really understanding the political system is knowing...
Which we don't, by the way. Just to clarify, as you can tell by these questions. Thank you, Neil, for your patience.
is that it's not gone through. What's happened is a division of the European Commission responsible for food and health safety responded positively to this European Citizens Initiative,
right?
Which is not exactly the same as saying they've even agreed to it. They just said they would endeavor to present a proposal by the end of 2023 with the aim to phase out cages eventually.
Okay.
But a recently leaked draft impact assessment from this commission showed that they were considering like a pretty ambitious set of reforms, like a 10-year phase out for cages for egg-laying hens, some restrictions on broilers that, you know, could be turned into some real welfare improvements, like stunning requirements or for some of the five most farmed fish species, and some other provisions, including possibly applying these to imports, which would be a huge deal.
Yeah.
My understanding of the proposal right now is at the stage of like getting some more feedback from the other divisions of the European Commission, then they'll need to get an approval from this body called the College of Commissioners before being presented to the European Parliament and national governments, who will then come up with their own positions on what they think, come up with amendments, and then sort of hash it out over could be a number of years before it's finally adopted into law. And then only then the transition would begin.
Yeah, with a long timeline, I'm presuming.
Oh, potentially 10 years.
Yeah, the 10 years that they've proposed is like pretty in line with, if you look at countries that have agreed to phase out cages for egg-laying hens recently, they've also been using something like 10 years.
Yeah.
Obviously, the industry will push for 30, 40 years as infinity.
Yeah.
But like 10 years seems like a reasonable transition based on like historical precedent, not what we would like.
And like how long would this actually take to get to the stage where the national governments could even come back and have a position and then get to like an actual decision?
So my understanding is that like this can take like 12 to 18 months. What's complicated in this situation is that in May 2024, the European Parliament has elections, and it's possible that'll bring in completely new people, even more conservative people, less reform-minded, who not only might not agree with amendments that like their colleagues in the previous parliament had submitted, but maybe just don't want to move the proposal ahead at all.
Right.
And then later on in that same year, in October, the European Commission itself will end its term and a new commission will come in that may have the same people, but may have different people. And again, you could lose some of the momentum there.
Yeah.
So it's still like a long road.
Yeah, so complex. I feel like before we were talking about obviously the real advantages of you know, political leverage and how that's actually like very useful in a lot of contexts. But then I guess hearing about all of the different kind of stages and then, you know, maybe even amendments and the kind of watering down of the policy perhaps to end in something that is, you know, NGOs wouldn't even necessarily kind of agree with if the countries have like pulled it back to such an extent. Do you feel like we've been sufficiently prepared to take such a huge policy through? Is there anything we can learn from that process? Or is it just that it is just incredibly complex? There's always different stages, you know, potentials for elections, changes in leadership, having to build those relationships again. Have we kind of used experience like yours to make sure that we've, you know, really push that process and been quite clever in the positioning of getting something like that through? Or do you feel like there is sort of learnings from that process that could help us in a future endeavor?
That's a great question. I think in the process of getting the European Citizens Initiative in the first place, that was a really great success and involved like really a lot of mobilization of the movement.
Yeah.
I think we should really study that and learn like how that was able to be done.
And that was across lots of different NGOs, right?
Big lots coalition. Of different NGOs, lots yeah. of different countries, different languages, yeah. somehow getting everyone to agree to mobilize activists in their country to support this particular ask.
Yeah. yeah.
And to make it concrete, I think they got over 1.2 million signatures or in that ballpark, yeah. is that yeah. right?
Something like that.
Yeah. And honestly, my baseline for success when I first heard about this ECI was pretty low because very few European citizens initiatives have ever gotten enough signatures. And even the ones that have, many of them, just nothing has happened.
Right.
So I think it's like really something to be commended that they managed to get enough signatures and actually get a positive response from the commission.
Mm. Yeah.
And then on everything that's come after that, I think there's been a lot of really great work done by advocates in European countries trying to gather evidence in support of these proposed reforms, trying to push their national governments into thinking this is actually something we can support or at the very least not oppose.
Yes.
And I think there's still like more work to be done there. I think in future versions of this, anticipating what those data needs are much farther in advance would be really helpful, because if these policymakers are like, we want studies on the economic impacts of this and that, you're like, well, great, that'll take 5 years to produce.
Right. So having that upfront. Right.
And maybe just so I can improve my very rudimentary understanding of EU policy, but do you think those upcoming re-elections and change of term of the European Commission, do you think that will significantly hinder the prospects of and the KJ becoming a reality, and kind of basically how likely do you think it is that it will come to fruition given those challenges you laid out?
So there were two recent events hosted by the advocacy movement. There was one from Compassion World Farming and one from Eurogroup for Animals, where they brought together policymakers and members of the European Parliament to talk about this. And I was like deeply depressed at the sentiment from members of the European Parliament about this, that they really were like, this is not a sure thing. Industry is already pushing us very strongly to just don't talk about this, don't table it, wait until the next election when we anticipate there'll be more conservatives who will support this elected. And they expressed like a genuine fear that not only will not much progress be made between now and those May elections, but that genuinely it could just be dropped. I don't know how real that fear is. On Metaculus, this like forecasting platform, there's like a 64% probability that we see a cage-free proposal before October 2024. Like my probability is actually higher that we'll see the proposal. And then there's like a subsequent question that's like conditional on that proposal being made. What would be the phase-out deadline set for cages for egg-laying hens? And the consensus is around the mid-30s. So at least this forecasting platform that have some record of being correct on predicting things seem like still reasonably optimistic that it'll go through. But again, I don't think we should just take it for granted.
We
can sit back, it's going to happen. Like, we still actually have to do the work.
Yeah.
It's the same as all of the kind of cage-free corporate commitments. We've had a lot of conversations at the conference this week about this sense of accountability and needing to follow through on those. It's not enough to, unfortunately, just push it over the line to get it to the point where we've got the decision. It's like working right through to the timeline, making sure it's implemented. And I guess this feels similar where, yes, it's got to this point, but those activists and organizations need to continue to push that in their own region to make sure it actually goes through and it's not just, kind of dropped or diluted to a point where all that hard work isn't paying off.
Yeah. And I think be prepared to compromise.
Right.
That's just how the policy process is. You're not going to get everything you want.
Yeah.
And there's like a real danger that exactly because this reform package includes so many tantalizing things that everyone's been wishing for.
Yeah.
It'll be hard to unite people around like what are the high impact things here that we should really make sure get through versus these other things which are like eventually must haves for like animal liberation, but like right now maybe are not where we have the most evidence to support our case.
Right.
And so be willing to like, maybe accept a 10-year transition, maybe a 12-year.
Yeah.
If it gets through the like high impact thing that we want.
Yeah, I don't fancy coordinating the that. I think that'll be a very challenging process to get everybody to agree. But really worthwhile if we can push through those high numbers, huge numbers of lives that will be affected. Interesting. And is there any other kind of promising legislation from the EU at the moment? Or is it kind of, as you said, all waiting until this new election passes in 2024 before anything else is starting up?
I don't currently have at the top of my mind any other legislation like more impactful than the ones I've mentioned being proposed by this commission. The new commission could be more progressive. It could be less progressive. Plausible to me that you could see more movement in the sort of alternative proteins, plant-based food, because those will be wrapped up in other like environmental sustainability goals that the commission is pushing for and other EU governments already agree with. But I don't know like specifically what those things are and like how they would stack up against these.
Does the progress of End the Cage Age as a European Citizens Initiative make you kind of more or less optimistic about that approach in terms of using those citizens initiatives or about initiatives, including the ones in the US as well, like Prop 12.
Yeah. So like I said, the European Citizens Initiative went much better than I would have expected based on the like small N of cases that we had already. And I think it's great that it got a positive response and it seems to be on track to have some significant change. I think it's great that Prop 12 in the US was passed and also survived this Supreme Court challenge. And, you know, could lead to lots of animals being out of extreme confinement. I also don't want to just pretend that you can solve every problem with a European Citizens Initiative. Or
feels like you can only do so many, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and like their success depends on like the type of issue that you're bringing, the salience to the public. How easy is it? Or how good is this actually for animals? How much organizational capacity is required to get this through? Do you need, again, like every organization in every EU country, every activist to do this? Or can you do this with a much smaller crew?
Feels like specifically unique to cage-free as well. I think this is talked about a lot again in the corporate relations space, that it's it is a salient topic because it's very black and white. The animal's either in the cage or it's not. But then when we go into things like broiler commitments and we're talking about stocking densities and breed and other challenges that are just way more difficult to communicate, I think we get into like such technical challenges that it's just so difficult to communicate. Whereas you're asking members of the public across Europe, do you want animals to be in cages or out? It seems like a very simple answer. And the majority of the population, even if they're, you know, not vegan or even particularly interested in other animal welfare topics, I think this one in particular stands out as being fairly simple to get a yes. So yeah, I think it's been probably a unique opportunity to get this through the European Commission. And perhaps in the future, the asks are going to be more challenging to clarify in a way that the public would get behind in such masses as they did for this one in particular.
Yeah, I think like a useful heuristic I have for policymaking is like engage the public on like moral issues, like animal cruelty, and engage policymakers discreetly on technical issues.
Right.
Yeah. It's good framing. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah, makes sense.
Cool. Well, moving a bit on to, I guess, your work at Rethink Priorities and research stuff more broadly. What are some examples of animal welfare-related research that Rethink Priorities has done that you think has been particularly impactful or influential? And this can be, I guess, animal welfare or some of your work on alternative proteins as well.
So I think we really helped put concern for invertebrates on people's mind and on the map in this space. Like many of my current and former colleagues, including Daniela Waldhorn and Jason Shoecraft, published invertebrate sentience research way back. I believe our research was influential in charity entrepreneurship, considering shrimp welfare as an idea and the eventual founding of Shrimp Welfare Project. I suppose this podcast would have a different name if those animals weren't considered.
Yeah, how are those little chickens? It would have been so boring.
And now there's an insect institute led by Justin Crummett, and the RP team is like continuing to try and produce more work in this area. We've also like recently produced a moral weights project led by Bob Fisher, providing this framework that can be used in making comparisons between interventions when you like take into account capacity for welfare of various species. And animal charity evaluators announced that they're updating their scoring framework to take into account these weights. And you can imagine if the animal advocacy movement took this seriously into their decisions. Yeah, corporate campaigns continue to look very good, but you should probably update towards more work on shrimp farmed for food and insects farmed for animal feed where there are tractable ways to do that.
That feels like a pretty big if. How many tractable options do you think there actually are in those fields?
I think the example of Shrimp Welfare Project shows that there are tractable wins there. They seem to have had success with this different approach of producer outreach and even like just buying stunners for shrimp to remove this idea that there isn't a supply. So it seems plausible to me that there are many other countries that farm a lot of shrimp. You could replicate that. I think it's too early to say right now what we should be doing for insects. I know there are people really thinking hard about it and trying some things, but I don't think it's something we should just step into blindly and too quickly.
And not even, I think, like what you were saying before about being like salient with the public, I feel like this isn't even a topic that members of the like animal community, you know, are even even beginning to understand, you know, myself absolutely included. So I think, very, very challenging and needs to be assessed like carefully as to how we approach this as a topic for sure.
That said, people also say it's a very pivotal time for the insect industry, and in many ways it's scaling up massively as people want to use it. In aquaculture, so there's also this tension of, do we wait to get some more like understanding of the movement before we step in, or has that ship sailed and we should step in now, even though it was a bit rough and ready? Do you have any takes on that, Neil?
I think, yeah, you're exactly right. The rocket ship is taking off. Trillions of animals are going to be farmed in probably horrible conditions. I'm unsure if we can stop that rocket ship. Maybe we can slow it down. Maybe we can improve the conditions in which those animals are farmed. And I think there are people like thinking hard about what that should be and trying to engage. But I don't think it's the case that like every animal advocacy organization should open up a insect division.
Yeah. It's interesting that you said that ACE have communicated as well that going to update
their scoring framework.
Yes, that's right. I feel like I'm really pleased that you're receiving tangible and useful feedback. I often find with the type of research work that you do, it's really difficult to collect like our organizations updating any of their sort of advocacy or campaign work based on the research. So actually having some real kind of tangible results from ACE, I imagine, has been well received by the team.
Definitely. It's really wonderful to see people take what can often be this like meta esoteric pie in the sky research and see it actually implemented in the real world and affecting people's actions and their decisions, and for them to tell us that.
Right.
So please, if you've been influenced by our research, tell us.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, I want to double click on that because I also run a research charity, and we found out that some of our work had influenced a donor to start this new program funding grassroots activism to the tune of £200,000 a year, and they didn't tell us. We heard through a second source a year and a half after it happened, and I was like, why didn't you tell us this? It's so annoying. It's like one of our most impressive things so far, and radio silence. So yeah, I can definitely attest that.
And do you do like a survey to sort of collect data and ask people to fill in? I think Fornalytics do something similar, don't they?
Yeah, so on a regular basis, and particularly at the end of the year, we interview a bunch of these like most important stakeholders that we anticipate like will use our research to get a sense of like what value they think the research has had. We also have a framework for estimating like the ex ante and ex post impact of a project, like in which we consider.
Do you want to explain what those words mean?
Okay, to estimate what do we think the impact of the project will be before we've actually done it. And then when we've done the project and we've seen what it actually looks like, estimate, okay, what do we think would happen after?
Yeah.
So like some things that we consider in that is like, if the project has led to results that should encourage people to revise some fundamental opinions or behaviors, then like if that target audience actually did revise them and did so like correctly in the direction that we would have suggested. Yeah. And that can be in the form of changes in money spent per year in a relevant area or in the share of money spent.
Would you say your main audience is funders and donors in the animal space, or like who are the main stakeholders you're trying to reach with the research?
Yeah, I think we're primarily aimed at improving the decisions of philanthropic foundations and major donors in the space, and then also aligned animal advocacy organizations and like new entities that like sometimes we directly incubate. To a lesser extent, like our work and influence policymakers and academics, but that hasn't been like traditionally a major focus of our work.
You said you had this framework for estimating the impact of the work before you've done it and after you've done it. And yeah, is that something you do for all the projects? And is there some kind of bar you have for saying, okay, we think the value of the research will be X amount, therefore we should go? Or yeah, how do you decide whether to even embark on a project?
I would love to say we have a very strict number. It's much more like fuzzy and like depends on what are the other projects that we're considering or have capacity to do and sort of ranking them to see which in general seem like they have the highest expected value and matching them with what are the skills of the actual researchers who have time available.
And in terms of that post section, that kind of evaluation of if it was kind of successful or it had like more impact than you were anticipating, perhaps, how do you evaluate the research that you have undertaken? And within that survey and assessing kind of who's used the research and who's updated based on it, do you actually just do that in-house or is there like someone externally that you bring in to provide that evaluation?
Historically, we've just done it in-house by just directly surveying the stakeholders. More recently, we've also just been asking the team themselves, like, hey, you might have heard from someone that the project you did 2 years ago had some impact. Like, make sure you write that down somewhere. And then we try and collect that all in one sort of central location.
Do you see that there's actually a reasonably big time lag between research output and like impact, so to speak?
As much as possible, we try and design projects with like a clear path to impact with maybe short-term, intermediary, and long-term results that we could actually measure so that we have some idea early on, like was that worth it? Or did we need to, even in the course of doing the project, might have some measurements to see like, is this likely to update people in terms of their behaviors or their opinions based on what we already have or what it looks like we'll have? And if not, maybe change strategy there. But yeah, I think it is unfortunately often the case that a lot of this research, especially the fundamental research about are these groups of animals sentient, is going to be something you don't see cash out for like many years later, potentially.
And how do you prioritize the topics of the research that you undertake? Is that also kind of personally led by the research, or is it a certain percentage of like the Rethink Priorities as an organization wants to pursue certain topics, but then perhaps the individual researcher also has some area that they want to pursue themselves? How do you kind of divvy up who does what and what percentage is personally influenced?
Yeah, it's quite a mixture of inputs. There can be generally what each researcher might think is a worthwhile thing to do just for the organization, if not even themselves, that we all submit together. There can also be leadership will present some ideas that they have based on their like idea of where the organization should be going. We try and get input from advocacy organizations about what they think would actually be useful to produce research and would change their opinions. And then also obviously funders on what they'd be like willing to fund. It's pretty helpful to know.
And for the animal welfare team specifically, how much of the research is led or directed by the team using Rethink Priorities' unrestricted budget versus commissioned by donors, roughly? Maybe this is a hard question on the spot.
Yeah, I wouldn't have the number offhand. I would say it's not a majority that's based on unrestricted funding. I would say like right now, still the majority of our funding is restricted. And then what's left over, we can prioritize. But often there's a good overlap between things we would want to do independent and things that various people have input into the process would want us to do.
How kind of future facing is the topic allocation? I guess I'm interested to know, like, organizations perhaps coming to you to commission something that's about a topic that they're working on right now, but also, as we were saying before, about insects and some of the fish welfare stuff and shrimp. I guess that was kind of looking into like new interventions and things that are going to affect animals, like way into the future, like the insect farming that's coming up. How kind of focused and how many years ahead, I guess, would you suggest that some of the research could even delve into to try and help us in 10 years time when we're like moving forward to thinking about species that might be farmed? Or is it quite focused on like the animals that are being worked on the most now?
That's a difficult one to answer because it's like changed over time, I would say, as
sure.
well. And also depends on the input from like the movement at the time. Like sometimes it's the case that advocates are like really interested in things that will help them right now. Yes. And other times that's just been less of a concern. And then we can like have the space to think more long-term. Also depends on what sort of long-term you're talking. A decade or 2 decade time frame. If you're thinking like thousands of years, we haven't really spent a lot of time thinking about the intersection of that with animals.
Maybe shifting gears a tiny bit is, so I think you mentioned earlier the Farmland on Thunder State of the Movement report, and in there, there's some interesting stats on how much of the current animal movement's budget is spent on research and measurement evaluation broadly. And I think the number off the top of my head is about 8% of the total 200 million. I think it's like 5% for research, 3% M&E, measurement evaluation. What are your thoughts on, does that seem like a reasonable amount? Should it be more? Should it be less? And yeah, what are your thoughts on how much of our total budget should go into this kind of research?
Yeah, so I think rightly, as you said, that the amount spent on animal welfare is like already a lot less than like spent on global health and development for humans. And the amount of animal welfare spending on research and development is, yeah, somewhere in that 5% to 10% range. And I think we've like produced a decent amount, not just our organization, but other research organizations have like produced a lot of meaningful impact from that 5% to 10%. But I could like strongly make the case with an obvious bias as a researcher that we could spend a lot more, maybe a few more percent, not like 50%, but a decent amount more on research now to sort of front load a lot of the research to answer some very basic foundational questions. And then like over time, spending less on research, more on doing the work on the ground, more on monitoring and evaluation. And obviously that those are interlinked. You would want to fund research that helps you come up with what are some new interventions we could be running, do monitoring evaluation of those interventions to feed back to see, do we need to iterate on them? Was this a terrible idea? Is this a great idea? And over time, hopefully we build up a solid evidence base that we're just like pretty sure what works, what doesn't work. And there isn't like a huge amount of need for this foundational research. But like the evidence side of the animal advocacy movement is like relatively new. So there's like a huge gap to fill. And I think there's like obviously a danger of just focusing too much on the direct work and then do the research later. It seems like you would want to do it in the other way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you think if you had to pick a number, it's like 10 to 15%, not bucket loads, but you think maybe almost double or a good chunk more than what we're doing now.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe not even double. Like I think it is. It's a hard case to make that money we could be spending on like cage-free corporate campaigns that we're like really confident help a lot of animals that are suffering should be spent on me sitting at a desk like researching some reports with the EU that maybe won't cash out for like a decade, right? I think if we're going to spend more on research, we should be pretty clear that like, yeah, this has a real need, like will really affect the strategy and tactics of the movement, but recognize we do need to do that and maybe it's worth spending more now.
Mm. And there has been an increase over the last few years, right? I remember Rethink kind of starting out in this. There's been quite a rapid growth already in that department. Do you have like a sense of when that when the farmed animal research work at Rethink began and up to now, like the change in even just the amount of animal researchers working in the team?
Yeah, so the Rethink began in 2018, basically, with like pretty small staff. I think we, until the pandemic, we had maybe 10 people total, and that was animal stuff.
Yes, yeah, so that's cross-cause areas.
Now we have like about a dozen people working on animals among an organization that has like, I don't know, I want to say 60 full-time equivalents.
Wow.
So, which broadly reflects more spending on research just in the EA movement, not necessarily just in animal advocacy. And there are lots of other research organizations. There's Animal Ass, there's Faunalytics, there's many more that I won't name, because I'll forget them, but I'm talking about you. And that's like great to see, but there could be more. I would like to see more like Rethink priorities out there doing other work on animal advocacy.
And you mentioned some of these foundational questions, but in your mind, what do you think are the most important animal-focused research questions that haven't been tackled yet or really could determine our strategy going forward?
So some of it is just like such basic, banal data that seems like almost not even worth mentioning, but like things like what we've been doing recently, like counting how many shrimp are like farmed for food, how many are in the wild. Like that basic knowledge should affect like our strategic priorities. And like not having that data means we could be spending a lot of resources, not on the wrong animal, but like not in proportion to like the amount of suffering that's out there. So I think there continues to be a need for just really basic data collection, both on numbers of animals, and on like what is actually happening in various interventions. Like when you are doing a corporate campaign, like what's actually happening on the ground? How long does it take to have an impact, like what tactics work, what don't, when you're trialing these new interventions, exactly again, what works, what doesn't, in what context does this thing work, but in other contexts doesn't. That's like where I think we're at. Like, it's still that very basic foundational level where you're understanding the basic animal welfare problems, assessing current solutions, identifying like new promising ideas, and then like more meta level questions about interspecies comparisons of animals. I think like we still need to do like all of those things. But here's some like more specific ideas. So like sentience of small invertebrates like brine shrimp used as feed for juvenile fish. I think that should be something we spend a lot more time on. Again, just like staying in the juveniles, like fish. There's like an enormous amount of fish in the juvenile stage. And it's possible that a lot of the well issues we see of farm fish in the grow out stage are like downstream of what happened to them in hatcheries. The temperature, the light, the handling, and like dealing with that might have like really big impacts on their welfare status when they're in the grow out stage. Obviously, I think we should spend like be doing more on policy work, like how to do it, when to do it, like how do you build a political movement to support that policy work? My colleagues like Jacob and Samara and Ben have been working on like alternative protein research and like understanding in what situations are like alternative proteins actually displacing conventional meat consumption and production? When is it a complement? When is it a substitute? Like that's key to that theory of change and like doesn't have the solid evidence base that I think it should have for us to be really confident in like pushing that forward. I would like to see a lot more research into understanding the impact of even the existing alternative proteins and the impact of like new ones that come online.
Yeah, maybe both on the policy side and potentially alternative proteins. How do you think about the trade-off between doing somewhat theoretical desk research versus actually trying something out and seeing how it goes? Because I can imagine maybe in the point you had about building a political movement, you know, how would you actually research how to do that? Is that just historical case studies, or is that just the thing where you just have to do it and see what happens and keep iterating on that?
Yeah, I definitely think at some point you reach diminishing returns from doing desk research case studies of other movements. I think we've done like some of that. There's probably still more to do. But then, yeah, use that as the basis for let's pick one jurisdiction, let's trial a type of political movement building towards a specific ask, try a different type of political movement building towards maybe the same ask, maybe a different ask in a different jurisdiction, set up the monitoring and evaluation system, collect that data, and like generate maybe more academic papers, more blogs and things for the movement. But yeah, I think we should try things while keeping in mind what are the potential downsides. You don't want to step into the political realm and like massively polarize the issue more than it already is, or you know, poison the well of public support for this.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think a lot of this information you can't get simply from desk research. You actually do need to go out on the ground and see like how do our like theories interact with the real world.
Great. Moving on a little then to the EA, the Effective Altruism Animal Welfare Fund. So you've recently joined the fund as a fund manager, they're called, right? Can you say a bit about the fund and what it does and how you ended up being one of the managers there?
Yeah, so it's an expert managed fund for donors interested in maximizing their impact for non-human animals. It's one of the four funds run by the Effective Altruism Funds. We aim to grant out all that we get in a calendar year in that same calendar year. And as of May 2023, it's funded payouts of over 15 million since its inception.
Just in the animal fund?
Just in the animal fund.
How much is that roughly per year, if you have an idea?
I don't have the number off the top of my head. I don't think it's like evenly divided between the years since inception. Okay. Because I think they've successfully managed to attract more funding over time. And then how I came to it. So we had a project on the EU that was like pretty successful in convincing funders to deploy funds to many European groups to support this End the Cage Age initiative. And through advising that, I was able to get some experience in evaluating grants, talking to groups, understanding how their work can be supported by funding and different levels of funding. And that, I think, gave me a good case to apply to be on the fund. So I gave it a shot, and they were happy to give me a trial anyway. Yeah, I'll continue to do it as long as it seems like my comparative advantage to help out there.
Very cool. And within that, then, does that mean you mostly focus on EU-related grants, or do you kind of do quite a broad range of grant valuation?
I do a broad range. I try to like very actively stay up to date on various aspects of the movement, various different interventions, what groups are doing what, so that I can like fairly evaluate different applications, and then obviously recuse yourself from ones where you'd have a conflict of interest.
Are there particular projects that you've come across that have seen through the fund that you're particularly excited about?
I think things that I'm like particularly excited about are things that hit these large scale neglected animals farmed or otherwise impacted by the food system, like crustaceans and other invertebrates, shrimp and fish, large scale neglected geographies like we've talked about, like in Asia and Latin America, other low middle income countries. Things on like wild animal welfare still like seem massively neglected, even though it seems like a really hard problem. So like when I see a really promising application on that, that's like really great. And then like the last category that seems really exciting is like these alternatives to using animals, like alternative proteins.
And what are some things you've learned from moving to like a kind of grant making, grant evaluation side of things that either surprised you or just like a new skill you picked up?
Yeah. So something I was like surprised by is that some grants are obviously really good or really bad and can be quickly decided upon. But like marginal grants are often split between ones that could be really bad or could be really good. And you should spend the time like figuring that out, devote like disproportionate amount of time to those. And then there are ones that where you're not really sure, is that just above or below the threshold in comparison to others? And that can like take a lot of time to figure out, but not actually be like a particularly impactful opportunity or like use of your time relative to like other things you could be doing. So that's been like a hard thing for me to learn, not to simply set aside a specific time for every application, but some are obviously good, some are obviously bad. Devote most time to the ones that could be really good or bad, but you need to spend the time to figure it out.
No, then what do you end up doing with the ones that are like just about on your threshold?
Yeah, unfortunately, you end up spending a lot of time on them and then thinking, damn.
Okay. Do you have some kind of like time box where you say you'll only spend 10 hours if it's like a 50,000 grant? Or do you have any kind of heuristics like that you use to think about your time?
Yeah, I try and have a rough rule of thumb of the bigger the grant, probably the more time you should spend, especially if it seems like it could be one of these really good ones.
Yeah.
Out of interest, what is the average time you think you'd spend on the 50,000 or an average size grant? I don't know how big they are in the animal welfare fund.
I think you can spend like on all grants, like from as little as like 1 hour to as much as 40, right? Really delving in, including all the time to reach out to references, to do your due diligence, to really interrogate all the aspects of their theory of change.
Wow.
Yeah, big commitment. Moving on to some closing questions then. Is there any bit of news that you're grateful or excited about recently that would be good to share with our listeners?
Yeah, so just this week, there was news in the European Union about this big reform package for farmed animals, where it managed to clear this like regulatory hurdle, where you had this really obscure agency called the Regulatory Scrutiny Board. It's composed of a bunch of technocratic economists given a negative opinion for the proposal. Basically, they said, we don't think this is like good enough, and it's too harsh to impose on industry, something like that. And now they've issued a second opinion that's positive, which means the legislation can like continue to go through to the proposal stage.
Great.
So that's like really reassuring to know that hasn't just died there.
And is that after like pressure? How come the decisions are so, or the opinions first and second are so different?
So the first thing to say is that like the baseline data would tell you that like 40% of first opinions from this board are negative. And then it's only like one or two a year that end up getting like a double negative opinion.
Right.
Okay. So it's pretty common to get a negative opinion first time and a positive opinion the second time.
Right.
I think advocates behind the scenes have tried to change that opinion by showing like actually the evidence is in support of this. But I don't have the inside scoop.
Sure. On that.
Cool. In terms of bits of media you'd recommend to listeners? So like books, podcasts, articles, anything, any kind of things you want to share that's either research focused, EU, or about general things that have helped you in the movement?
Yeah, I've got some like niche political science ones for you.
Definitely.
So, you know, I hope you enjoy these. I really got a kick out of Mike Duncan's podcast, Revolutions, and like in particular, season 7 on the 1848 revolutions in Europe that attempted to overthrow absolute monarchies and basically failed. I think there's actually like some really interesting insights there about how you form a coalition, how you avoid a victory turning into a loss when the movement like sort of turns on itself.
Right.
And also how like relatively enlightened thinkers from the time can like be so blind to like other moral issues, which is like, I think, very relevant in the animal world.
We'll link that below because that's going to be sufficiently niche. I think no one will find it otherwise. But yeah, we'll include a link to that and other stuff Neil is obviously going to talk about.
Good luck. You can listen to the whole series. really, really recommend it. There's also one about the history of Rome that I'm happy to recommend. No relevance to animal advocacy. It's a great time.
Okay.
Then I also listened to your interview with David Comenheide, who recommended Engines of Liberty. And I think that's great. And as a compliment, I'd maybe recommend Defeating Authoritarian Leaders in Post-Communist Countries, like 2011. It's a book. What I particularly like about it is that they take a really scientific approach to understanding why did some authoritarian leaders lose to democratic opposition while others did not. And they set up like a bunch of competing theories of change and look at whether the evidence supports or refutes key parts of that theory of change. And I think we should be doing something similar in the advocacy movement, not just telling like neat stories, but like, here's our theories. What evidence would we expect to see? Do we see that evidence?
Yes.
And sort of knock out theories of change that aren't that promising and like go all in on the ones where we are seeing like evidence.
Yeah.
And then the last one is the most recent season of the Danish political drama Borgen.
Wow.
You know,
this is so niche.
I don't know. This is amazing.
I love it.
And one of the subplots in that
is... Can we get a timestamp, please?
How do you spell Borgen?
B-O-R-G-E-N.
Got it. Okay.
And yeah, one of the subplots in this amazing Danish political drama is that the child of the foreign minister is an animal rights activist.
Oh, wow. Dun, dun,
dun. And I'm not Danish, but for my Danish friends, my impression is the show does a really good job of reflecting what politics is really like. So I think it'd be really interesting to watch that and see how this animal issue is framed.
Yeah.
And get some lessons for people who are thinking about policy.
Is that season one? Or just
The most recent season, which I think is 3.
Okay. Okay, great. I'm actually quite excited for that one.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, we'll link all those things, plus some stuff before about the Rethink research as well we mentioned. And also you can donate to the Animal Welfare Fund as well if you want to support great grant-making opportunities as well. So that's another way you can help out.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Neil. This has been great. Really, really interesting. I think, for anyone who is not familiar with Rethink's work, definitely head to the website. Such a plethora of information on there about how to best support the advocacy efforts of your organization. I've really enjoyed learning more about this kind of political angle and how to push policy. I feel like any area that I'm not that familiar with, I always find really interesting. So yeah, thanks from me for your time.
Yeah, thank you very much. I really appreciate the podcast and the range of different views that you're bringing onto it. I think it's really important to hear lots of different perspectives.
Sure.
Thank you, Neil. Thanks for coming.